Speaking on the program at this time is Brother James W. Boyd.
Now let's go to Luke chapter 22. We begin tonight with verse 39, but first I want to go back and take note of verse 36 where he said about, "But now he that hath a purse, let him take it likewise, his scrip, and he that hath no sword, let him sell his garment and buy one." And why would the Lord tell his apostles to have a sword? Well, their response to him in verse 38 was, "Lord, here are two swords." And he said, "It is enough." Now, first of all, we need to know that a sword is a weapon that can be used offensively for the advancement and the conquering of something, or it can be a weapon of defense for one's own protection. It's quite obvious that God does not allow the spreading of His kingdom to be accomplished by carnal warfare. That's not the way the church grows. It grows rather by the winning of the hearts and minds of people, not military enslavement of people. Therefore, we know that the Lord did not admonish them to have a sword to advance the kingdom. Well, there's only one other reason then for them to have a sword. Things were going to change for them. When they had been sent out on the commission to preach the gospel just to the Gentiles, to the Jews, he told them that their clothes wouldn't wear out, their shoes wouldn't wear out, they'd always have sufficiency. But he said, now up here in verse 36, things are going to be different. So you better take provisions. And the only reason on earth that they would have the necessity for a sword would be something for their own defense, should they need it. He says it is enough. But it was enough for something else. It was enough for the Lord to teach about the use of the sword, which He does and which He demonstrates just a little further in this chapter, and we'll touch upon that when we get to it. Now in verse 39, He came out and went, and as He was wont, or that is, as He was accustomed, this word W-O-N-T, it's not W-O-N apostrophe T, as we are acquainted with, but this word wont, W-O-N-T, is an archaic word, a word that we do not use normally in our conversation. It's not an incorrect word, it's just an old word. You look it up in the dictionary, you'll find the meaning of it. And it simply means that he went out as he was accustomed to doing. It was his habit, accustomed to the Mount of Olives. And his disciples also followed him. And when he was at the place, he said unto them, "Pray that ye enter not into temptation." Now our Lord knew what was about to transpire. He knew that he was about to be seized. He knew their faith was about to be tested. He knew that they were going to encounter a circumstance that they had not contemplated. He knew they were very vulnerable. In fact, he had already spoken to the Apostle Peter up here about some things that made Peter rather indignant, but he had told him, "You'll deny me three times before the cock crows." And so Christ said, "Pray that you enter not into temptation," which inescapably implies to us that in facing trials and temptations, there is power for our benefit in prayer. Otherwise, there'd be no need for the Lord to instruct them to pray. Talking with God is a way to be able to face those roadblocks and pitfalls that the devil might place before you or dig before you in your path. And when he was withdrawn from them about a stone's cast, and kneeled down and prayed. Now he prayed, saying, "Father, if thou be willing, remove this cup from me. Nevertheless, not my will but thine be done." What cup? And this was a figurative expression. What was he talking? It's the cup of suffering that Jim Elrod has correctly said. He was about to drink, absorb this suffering that he was called upon to endure. Now keep in mind, He was, as we have noted before, both deity, but as well humanity. And it would be the human reaction, the human side of Christ, that would, if he could, avoid that which was about to befall him. And I think we need not belabor the reasons why. The excruciating trial, the mockery, the humiliation, the suffering, the eventual death, the whole thing. Why, certainly, from a physical standpoint, from a human standpoint, he would that there would be another way. But note his attitude. And we need to have this attitude because we're to walk in his steps. Not my will, but thine be done. Now, this was the way of Jesus Christ here upon this earth, and this is to be the way of those who are his followers, to always pray the Father's will. Whatever it is, that it's the Father's will, that's what we want. We don't always know how to pray. We don't always know what God might providentially have in mind for us. We know he cares. We know he watches over us. We don't always know how God's providence even works. We just are simply assured of it in his infallible word. But it should always be our disposition of heart that God's will prevail. Now, someone has once said, God's will prevail. Yes, that's right. But it should be our disposition of heart which shows our dependence and our submissiveness unto him. That's what we want too. Whatever it is, that's what we want too. And that was that for which Christ was praying here. And again, we see that Christ prayed because he was about to face a tremendous trial. And there is power in prayer. James tells us in James 2 and verse 16, the effectual fervent prayer of a righteous man availeth much. And I'm sure that I need not have to contend before you that we are convinced, are we not, of the efficacy, the power, the value, the benefit of prayer. Notice verse 43, and there appeared an angel unto him from heaven, strengthening him. This is a tremendous point right here that we might overlook if we're not careful. Christ prayed, and I'm going to paraphrase, not to trivialize, but just to paraphrase. Christ prayed, I wish this wasn't what I'd have to endure. I wish it could be another way. However, whatever it is your will, whatever is your will, that's what I want. God did not, the Father did not spare him the suffering, but he strengthened him to endure it. He strengthened him in some way, didn't he? That's as far as we have evidence to go on. But the point that I would like to make is like in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 13. That there hath no temptation taken you, but such as is common to man. But God is faithful, you can count on God, he's dependable, who will not suffer or permit you to be tempted above that you are able, but will with the temptation also make a way that ye may be able to bear it or endure it. He may not always remove the problem, but he will strengthen us to endure the problem. You see the distinction between avoiding the problem, being relieved of the problem, or keeping the problem, but able to endure the problem. And that's what he provided for Christ here. Strength to endure. All right? And being in agony, he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat was, as it were, great drops of blood falling down to the ground. I've heard sometimes people, and maybe they got their tongue tangled up a little bit, but they're talking about how Christ sweat blood. No. It didn't say that. There was perspiration coming from him in this agony and this anxiety and this burden upon him was as great drops of blood. It was heavy perspiration. Our Lord was in agony already. And when he rose up from prayer, when it was come to his disciples, he found them sleeping for sorrow. Those now riding back from the lectureship, which we had the privilege to attend the first 2.5 days this week from Memphis. Somebody just let you know, if I look tired, boy, you better know I am. I have had more fun. I have heard more good sermons since Monday afternoon than you'll hear all year. I'm sorry to say that. But I really have, but you sure get tired. Driving back wasn't any fun. Everybody and that dog was on the highway today. And well, by the way, we had them. Somebody take care of that dog over at the kennel. And so I had to go get the dog. Got the dog before I got home. The dog got sick. And then the car quit and it wouldn't run. And I just thought, boy, I'm putting 1 Corinthians 10:13 to the test right now. And I'm tired. But on the way home, we got to talking about this. Now, I'd studied my lesson before, but I want to have it read again. And I said, Rosalind, read this. She's not here tonight. She's sick as a mule. She just wore out. Came back to the chest cold and said, Reverend, don't you tell her I said anything about it. She said, don't say anything. So I told her, okay. So I hadn't, everything I've said is nothing. So I didn't say anything. But she was reading this, and we got talking about, what does it mean here? He found them sleeping. Now, I got you so far. Sleeping for sorrow. And we wrestled with that for about 20 miles. What do you think it means? Seriously. What's the significance here? And I'm asking as much as just it, trying to provoke discussion. Sleeping for sorrow. Anybody? Any suggestions? You've been talking real. That's exactly what she said. And I said, no, that didn't make sense, but you know, the further we got down the road. Y'all hear what he said? You can lose a loved one, be overcome with grief and sorrow, that it will physically exhaust you, will it not? And I'm sure that many of you have personally experienced that kind of exhaustion. Let me just say here in passing, when your loved ones die, you need to take care of yourself. That's not selfish. That's just sensible. Right? Because you can harm your own health, not only emotionally but physically, under stress like that. But they didn't fully comprehend what was all taking place here, except he had already told them what was going to take place. And they said, no. And still they were sorrowful enough, and they were just exhausted. And that must have been the significance of their sorrow. They were anxious. They were bewildered. And he said unto them, why sleep ye? Rise and pray, lest ye enter into temptation. Here again, they were going to face temptation. Here again was the avenue to be able to meet it. It was through prayer. And while he yet spake, behold, a multitude. And he that was called Judas, one of the 12, went before them and drew near unto Jesus to kiss him. But Jesus said unto him, Judas, betrayest thou the Son of Man with a kiss? Now this is as Judas had made a covenant with the enemies of Christ to do. Why? Inasmuch, and I had a professor in college one time to ridicule the Bible on this point. Said all the stuff about Judas having to identify Christ. Said, didn't it say he was with the multitude all the time? Certainly they knew who he was. Why did Judas have to point him out? And you know, I didn't have the answer for that fellow that day. But when the class met next time, I had the answer. Because I asked somebody. I couldn't figure it out. But why did Judas have to point him out? Yeah, it fulfilled prophecy, but there must have been some pragmatic, practical reason for it. Wouldn't they? Couldn't they have recognized him? Hadn't they seen him all the time? What time of day was it? Isn't it nighttime? Where were they? They weren't in a lighted area, were they? How many people were there? At least 12, weren't they, of Christ and his apostles? They wanted to make sure they got the right one. And who would quicker spot and detect which one was the right one than one that had been one of his own? And so, there's a very logical, sensible reason why it proceeded in this fashion. And notice how Judas, he didn't say, "That's him, take him." He didn't point to him. It's ironic and it's almost blasphemous that Judas chose an expression of affection, an expression of greeting, such as you would use with an acquaintance with whom you are, for whom you have great fondness. He chose that manner with such blatant hypocrisy to betray his master. The kiss of Judas. Everywhere in all this world, that's an infamous deed, isn't it? What made that such an infamous deed, folks? Was the deed itself, did it look infamous and sinister? As I said, the very manner in which he did this was seemingly a manner of greeting, a manner of affection. What made it so dastardly ugly? It was the motive behind it, wasn't it? It was what was in the heart. If you were just a bystander or one who was standing off, you did not know the circumstances, you did not know the enmity between these people in Christ, you did not know how they were hated him and what they were all up to, and you just saw this group come up and this one man going up and greeting another in this fashion, why, you would have thought they're certainly cordial one with the other, aren't they? From all outward appearances it looked that way, didn't it? But it was the most ugly kiss ever. Why? Because of the evil that was in the heart of Judas. His motive behind it is what made it ugly. Therefore, I know that even things that might appear on the surface to be honorable and admirable can be as low as the human being can get. Isn't that true? For 30 pieces of silver, he sold his soul when he betrayed his Lord. Now, the event wasn't over. When they which were about him saw what would follow, they said unto him, "Lord, shall we smite with the sword?" And before he answered, one of them took action. And John tells us it was Peter. And he's swung it and cut off the ear of one named Malchus, who was a servant of the high priest. He was one of the mob that had come out. I think I've mentioned to you before, Brother Foy Wallace always injected the probability, he said, and I will go along with the possibility, that Peter was really swinging at his head and just missed a little bit and caught his ear. Maybe, maybe not. But you know, Peter had just said he would die for him. He was sincere about that, and he laid his life on the line. He grabbed that sword, and they said, "Lord, shall we smite with a sword?" Peter didn't ask. Peter didn't even wait for an answer. Peter swung. That seemed to be characteristic of this man and so many impetuous things that he did. Wasn't it, Brother Byers? He was taking the union. You know that. That's a characteristic of Peter. He sometimes would act and then later on think about it. And He cut this priest's ear off. In Matthew, we read that Jesus responded to put the sword in its place. He told Peter to put that up. Now, he told him to take a sword, and the use of the sword could be for their defense. He swung it and cut this man, injured him with it, but Christ was not going to be defended. Furthermore, when he said, put the sword into its place, the sword has a place. There's a place for the sword. There is a place for the proper use of the sword. This wasn't the place. It was not to be used in the defense of Christ. Nor was Peter one that was authorized to use it. He impetuously used it. And Christ, and this looked like, should have been rather convincing, except to the hardest of hearts. He restored the man's ear. Now that was a miracle right in the presence of the very ones who had come to seize him, and they weren't affected by it one bit. We wonder sometimes today, why do people do this? Why can't they see that? Why are they this way? Why are they so hardened that way? That's sort of been characteristic of people who have rebelled against the way of God. In the very face of all of this evidence of who he was and what he could do and the demonstration of it, even then, they weren't impressed. And they took him, they led him and brought him into the high priest's house. Notice, and Peter followed afar off. Now, he didn't stay with him, but Peter wouldn't completely abandon him. He wasn't close enough to him to do him any good or to be of any comfort or be of any help. And that was his problem. You know, sometimes people say, well, I'm really behind him. I've been in situations sometimes where it got a little tense. And after the thing was over, somebody come up, "Brother Boyd, I was behind you." I say, "Thank you. You know what I wanted to say? You were so far behind me, you didn't do me a bit of good." Now that's how far behind Christ's people are. But he followed them afar off, here in the darkness. And when they had kindled a fire in the midst of the hall and were set down together, Peter sat down among them. What do we have here now? The enemies of Christ, they brought him in, they built a fire, proceedings were about to take place before the high priest, they built this fire for themselves, and Peter sort of loses himself in the crowd as if he were one of them. Warm, you've heard the phrase many times, warming himself by the enemy's fire. I want you to watch something, folks. I think it's a tremendous contrast, something from which we can learn. When the Apostle Peter was in the presence of Christ and in the company of his fellow apostles, he vowed and declared he would die before he would ever deny Christ. He would give his life. In the company of those of like faith, he was strong. But the Bible says, not just to the disgrace of Peter, but to all of them, it says all of them forsook him and fled. All of them had said they'd do the same thing Peter did. All of them, however, forsook him just like Peter did. But now where do we find Peter? He's in with the enemies now, warming himself by the enemy's fire, not letting himself be identified as being one of them. Actually appearing to be one of the enemies, because he's just right along with them. And what happens? You're going to see that strength of Peter, that determination of Peter, that forthright declaration of Peter, what he would do and what he would not do. You're going to see that melt away before the enemy's fire. You know, folks, a lot of times, now you correct me if you don't think this is right, a lot of times people are strong when they're with those of strength, and you put them with those of sinister heart, they sort of go along with that too, don't they? That's sad. That's sad. Influence is a tremendous thing in our lives, and this is the reason we should seek good Christian association. If you will live your life amongst good, faithful brethren, you will be far less likely to go astray. But when you are going to be one of those who are going to be warming yourself by the enemy's fire, you're going to pull a stunt like Peter did. The influence runs against you. It runs the other way. This is one of the motives for guarding your associations. Now it says here in verse 56, "But a certain maid beheld him as he sat by the fire and earnestly looked upon him and said, this man was also wicked." Why, she knew, she had seen him in the company, no doubt, in the streets and so forth. Why, this man, he was with Christ, and he denied him. That's once. "Woman, I know him not." That's one. "And after a little while, another saw him and said, thou art also of them. And Peter said, man, I am not." That's two. "And about the space of 1 hour, after another confidently affirmed, saying, of a truth, this man also was with him, for he is a Galilean. And Peter said, man, I know not what thou sayest." And another account in Matthew said, "he cursed and swore." I don't know what you're talking about. I never knew that man. I don't have anything to do with him. That's three times. And then the cock crew. And this right here, what a look Peter got. And the Lord turned and looked upon Peter. Didn't say anything. He was near enough to where he knew what Peter had done. And when Peter had denied him three times, just like he said, the Lord just turned and looked at him. He didn't have to say anything, did he? Folks, it wasn't the Lord's look that convicted Peter so badly as it was that it brought to Peter's mind the words of Jesus Christ as to what he would do. And what a look. Did you ever have somebody just look at you? Not say a word. And see Mama and Daddy right now. Why, sometimes in church, what I'd be sitting with to start cutting up. And I knew they ought not be doing that. And I thought, I meet two eyes coming right at me. Mama wouldn't say it had that. She wasn't scowling, didn't shake her head. That just burned a hole right through me. Of course, if I didn't stop, burned a hole later on. But just a look. Didn't have to say anything, did she? I'd already been told. I'd already been warned. Just a look. That was a tremendous humiliation of the Apostle Peter. And he remembered the word of the Lord, how he had said unto him, "Before the cock crow, thou shalt deny me thrice." And Peter went out and wept bitterly. This word bitterly carries the idea with uncontrolled sorrow. He was beside himself. He was crushed. You know he was ashamed. And obviously his tears were the tears of one who was penitent. Because we see what he did later on. He didn't do like Judas, go out here and hang himself. He turned and became what we know the Apostle Peter later to become. But what a horrible moment for him. And what led to it? One thing that led to it was overconfidence. You don't read of Peter acting that way anymore. Was he? He wasn't quite so cocksure, as I'm not playing on the cock crowing. He just wasn't so arrogant. He just wasn't so sure of himself. He was humble. And he was penitent. And he didn't give up on himself. He came back. My, what a matchless servant of the Lord he became. I had a school teacher, old mean Miss Webb. She was a little old runt, but she was as nasty as she could be. And we were talking about this one day, and she said, yeah, Peter cried crocodile tears. You know what crocodile tears, you know, fake. Isn't that what you ever heard, crocodile tears? Like he wasn't sincere. And that's one time, I was just in high school, that's one time I had the answer. I said, well, if he wasn't sincere, he sure did act like he was sincere later on when he stood up right in front of that same bunch that called for Christ's crucifixion and preached his resurrection. He acted sincere then, didn't he? He was sincere. Subscriber, mark verse 63 at our beginning point next time.